It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strandchamps. Today, hitchhiking.
And it didn't take very long for these dreamways to be recast as highways to hell.
Now, I'm not one to pick up hitchhikers. You never know. Might be a hijacker.
I think the danger of hitchhiking is a little bit of the appeal. It's always like a joke about sex to hitchhike. It's always a joke about danger.
My mother told me never to do this.
He'll wish he'd taken his mom's advice.
Hitchhike to hell.
He opened the doors of hell.
Hitchhike to hell. There's no such thing as a free ride.
If you watch enough horror movies, you get the feeling that hitchhiking can be hazardous to your health. Very hazardous. But does anyone still hitchhike? Today we'll hear from cult film director John Waters. At age 66, he recently thumbed his way across almost 3,000 miles of American highways. And Israeli radio producer Mishi Harman tries to heal a broken heart by hitchhiking around the world. But first, was hitchhiking ever really as dangerous as the movies made it seem? Ginger Strand is the author of Killer on the Road, Violence and the American Interstate. She told us that back in the Great Depression, when American highways were still relatively new, everyone hitchhiked.
It was entirely normal. Even Emily Post thought that if you were going to your job, particularly during the war, if you were going to your job at a defense plant, it made sense to hitchhike. People picked up soldiers because soldiers used hitchhiking as a way of getting around the country, and that was your patriotic duty, in fact. It wasn't seen as dangerous. It had to be specifically redefined as dangerous, and that happened kind of beginning in the 1950s with the FBI campaign that really picked up in the 1960s.
What was the FBI's anti-hitchhiking campaign, and why were they against hitchhiking?
Well, one theory is that J. Edgar Hoover was really against the fact that students were hitchhiking to the South to register voters and hitchhiking from college to college to take part in demonstrations and protests and civil rights marches and things like that.
So are you saying that by the 60s, hitchhiking had taken on certain countercultural associations? It became associated with hippies and flower children?
Absolutely. And the hippies and flower children embraced hitchhiking. You know, it was part of their lifestyle. It was a way of being less materialist because you didn't have to own a car. It was a way of being more connected because you moved from place to place and met strangers and shared things with them. And so when cities and towns and even some states began passing anti-hitchhiking ordinances, the hippies saw that as a form of harassment.
So how did the FBI actually go about discouraging hitchhiking?
They actually made propaganda posters and placed articles in popular magazines and newspapers. So you see, if you look at the popular media, you see this vast shift from the 1940s and 50s and even the 60s, where hitchhiking is often written up as a reasonable, fun way to get around. And by the late 70s, the only kind of article you read is hitchhiking. It's like playing Russian roulette.
What did those posters look like?
There was a famous one that had a picture of a man in a suit, and he's got his back to the viewer, and there's a car with a family in it. This man in the suit is hitchhiking, and the poster's titled Death in Disguise. And there's kind of a skull superimposed on the whole thing.
Wait, so the hitchhiker was the one who was dangerous?
Yes.
Because that's shifted.
Yes, it did. It shifted in the 1970s with the countercultural embrace of hitchhiking.
Wait, how did it switch from the hitchhiker was the dangerous predator to the people in the car picking up the hitchhiker were potentially predators?
Yeah, I think that what happened is there were a few very high-profile cases of people who used hitchhiking as a means of serial killing. So for every one of those cases, the media just produced a lot of anxiety and fear about hitchhiking.
So aside from the public hysteria, was or is hitchhiking that dangerous?
It's an interesting question because no one's ever actually studied it. There was one report written in the late 70s by the California Highway Patrol, and they looked at all the crimes that were reported over a number of years and how many of them were associated with hitchhiking, and it was significantly less than 1%.
Does that strike you as odd that it hasn't actually been that studied?
Yeah, it strikes me as very odd.
I mean, why do you think that is?
Part of me thinks maybe the hippies were right. It could, in fact, be that we're just, as a society, we're more comfortable with people being in their own space. It's why we love our cars. It's very anti the car culture to hitchhike. We think of our cars as private space. It's like inviting a stranger into your home for dinner.
Yeah, well, maybe the powers that be don't especially want strangers meeting up and discovering that they have common interests and like each other.
It's interesting, though, there's been a bit of a resurgence. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times pointing out that hitchhiking was not necessarily as dangerous as we've all been led to believe.
Your op-ed basically called for people to start hitchhiking again.
Yes, it did. And I got lots of email from people all over the country pointing out that they were part of various kinds of projects. In today's world, where we're also wired, hitchhiking can be much safer than it ever could. You can take a photo of the car before you step in it, including the license plate, and immediately text that to your mother. People are much more able to protect themselves than they were in the 1970s. There's quite an active hitchhiking culture, although they don't call it hitchhiking, in many cities. Washington, D.C., surprisingly, is one of them. It's known there as slugging. The slugs line up at designated places, and people who want to drive in the HOV lanes pick them up.
I don't know. You said it's safer now with cell phones and you can snap pictures. There's a part of me that thinks, yeah, that just means that maybe they'll catch your killer after you've been left dismembered by the side of the road.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's a question of whether we want to invest in trusting people, whether we want to be the kind of culture that trusts people, or whether we're really committed to our distrust of anyone we don't know.
The point of your book really is that it's not so much the hitchhiker as, in some ways, the highway itself that evokes this sense of fear or unease in us. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I think so. It's the highway itself, and it's the world that grew up around it and the kind of world that it creates. The highway creates a very disconnected world that's not on a human scale. It's on an automotive scale.
I still don't understand why. I mean, when the highways were built, there was this great sense of national pride. This was a huge public works project. And you can imagine that we might still feel proud of it. And yet, there's these sinister overtones.
Yeah, it's really true. To me, it was very much about economics. When the highway system was first proposed, and when the first highways were built, people loved them. They saw them as beautiful. And it didn't take very long for these dreamways, as they were called, to be recast as highways to hell. And I think that one of the reasons for that is the effect that they had on urban areas and on landscapes. You know, at one point in California, the highway engineers proposed dropping 23 nuclear bombs on the Bristol Mountains in order to carve a path for I-40.
Wow.
Luckily, it didn't happen. But they were going to set up bleachers so that they could bring in dignitaries to watch. Everyone was very excited about this. And people who kind of thought skeptically about that said, this is what the highway system is. It's a kind of war on nature and a war on our landscape.
Ginger Strand is the author of Killer on the Road, Violence and the American Interstate. John Waters has a new book out called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Our producer Doug Gordon did an interview with John Waters recently. And Doug, before we hear that, can we get a little bit of background on who John Waters is? I know he's a really distinctive, flamboyant personality, kind of a cult figure.
Very much so. In fact, he's most famous, Anne, for the cult films he's made. Those films have earned him the nicknames the Pope of Trash and Cecil B. Demented. His black comedy, Pink Flamingos, that he made in the early 70s, it caused a lot of controversy when it first came out because the characters perform a lot of perverse acts in it. And that's probably as much detail as I should go into about that. Or would you like more details?
Well, as curious as I am, it's public radio, so maybe not. So did Waters really hitchhike across America?
He did. Yeah, and he told me that's something he used to do a lot as a kid, and that it was this fantasy he had. Could he hitchhike across America by himself, and what would happen? So 2 years ago, at the age of 66...
Wait, he's 66 and hitchhiking across America?
That's right. 66, 2 years ago, he's 66, hitchhiking from Baltimore to San Francisco, 2,800 miles. And he writes about what happened in the book, of course, but he also writes about what didn't happen, his best-case scenarios and his worst-case scenarios, these fictional accounts. I asked him if imagining these dream rides and nightmare rides was a way of dealing with his anxiety before he left on his trip.
It was hoping and dreading put together, hoping for the best stuff and dreading the worst. And as it got closer and closer, it became more of an abstract idea that what a book deal is than the truth. And I saw the fear in my friends' faces. I saw the kind of reluctance to go along with it with the people that worked for me. So, I mean, that started to make me nervous, which kind of got on my nerves because I thought, come on, let's be positive here.
The golden age of hitchhiking is long gone. What happened to it?
I think what happened to it is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hitchhiker. The Hitcher, the movie. Certainly, I bet there were always serial killers picking up people. I think it was probably always a little bit dangerous to hitchhike, but I think if you hitchhike, the chance of something horrible happen to you, it's much more probable you'll be in a car accident tomorrow than that happening. So everything's a little bit dangerous, and I think the danger of hitchhiking is a little bit of the appeal. It's always like a joke about sex to hitchhike. It's always a joke about danger. It's always the cliches of hitchhiking or genre movies.
The danger, as you say, it's part of the appeal. So I wondered if maybe you had somewhere in the back of your mind this vision of turning hitchhiking into the next big thing in extreme entertainment, you know, along the lines of extreme kidnapping, which people pay to be abducted.
Yeah,
you could have
yeah.
John Waters, extreme hitchhiking. You could even hire people to play scary drivers and pick up the clients?
No, I don't want to do that. I did imagine extreme drivers, certainly in the first part of the book, hideous ones. But I don't want to experience that for real. I liked experiencing it in fiction. I was glad that everybody that picked me up was a good driver. I had a cop. I had a coal miner, a trucker, a minister's wife, an African-American girl taking her baby to daycare. I had all kinds of people pick me up. And I would say maybe only a third knew who I was.
Getting back to this idea of the most hideous hitchhiker that you could have was the worst-case scenario of Randy Packard.
Who's a serial killer who only kills cult movie directors. Because everybody said, well, they're serial killers. I said, yeah, I hate to say this, but they usually kill teenage girl runaway hookers, right? And that's a shame, but they don't usually kill 66-year-old men. Even the gay ones, there's one serial killer that was a gay one that just killed, but he went to gay bars and picked them up as a trucker all along the highway. So I tried to think what would be the serial killer that would get me, that would be attracted to me. So I wrote a chapter about Randy Packard, who was, I guess, my ultimate fear. Plus, he had a venereal disease I had never heard of that hadn't been discovered yet, on top of it.
Yeah, to make matters worse. And this would probably be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from the Randy Packard chapter of your book.
We pull into the Las Vegas city limits. Time flies when you're being tortured. I see the ridiculous skyline of the town, a place filled with tourists I have spent my lifetime trying to avoid. Look, Randy, I groan through spasms of pain. Just let me out here. I promise I won't make any trash films again. I'll go make mainstream movies, I swear. It's too late for a career change, Randy snarls with murderous rage as he pulls his truck off the road into an abandoned drive-in movie theater. It's been a long time since any movies were shown here. There's not even a screen anymore, and the concession stand has been burned to the ground. The few remaining poles for the speakers have been stripped clean of working parts. Randy slams on his brakes with a sickening finality. Get in the back, Randy orders. No, Randy, please, I argue. Let's go see the Avengers. Let's go see Hollywood tentpole blockbusters. His answer? A bullet into my right foot. I almost pass out when he grabs me and throws me into the opening he has carved between the truck and the trailer he's pulling. Inside is a cult movie director torture chamber. Josie Cotton's cover version of the theme song of Who Killed Teddy Bear is playing on some sort of sound system. Beneath posters for El Topo is the decaying body of Alejandro Jodorowsky, who I thought was still alive until Randy tells me differently and takes credit. I see George Romero's amputated head hanging in a basket surrounded by posters for Night of the Living Dead and all its sequels. Enough is all Randy offers in explanation. Before I can scream, I trip over what appears to be a corpse clawed away by wild animals. Randy kicks it, and I realize this poor human is still alive. I try to look away, but Randy grabs my head in a chokehold and forces me to gaze upon this nauseating face. Oh, my God. It's Herschel Gordon Lewis, and he chuckles when he sees me. He's still got a sense of humor, even as he approaches death.
Excellent reading. Thank you. You write about these dream rides, the best-case scenarios. Do you have a favorite dream ride?
Well, I guess the first one, the one that picks me up and gives me $5 million to make the movie I've been trying to make in cash and tells me that there won't be any notes and he doesn't really care if he gets his money back or it makes money. And he's a pot dealer that has a corrupt FedEx office that's manned by people that look like they've escaped from the Whole Foods employee jail.
Yeah.
You know that look.
Oh, I know that look. So let's talk about reality now. We have to talk about signage. You wanted to go old school, cardboard signs. Why?
Well, it works. I think it's your ad campaign. Although people think you're a beggar, because the only time they see anybody now with a cardboard sign is when you were standing at a red light begging money. So they, I thought I was so stupid or so schizophrenic that I didn't know that you should stand at red lights. Like, how would I collect change down on the entrance ramp? Like, people run by and hold a basket and they throw quarters at me. That would have been good. I should have tried that.
Should have, yeah. Next time.
The human toll booth. No, set up my own toll booth and see if it worked.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you wrote different things on the signs. Which worked best?
I found out the humor didn't work. I had one that said, I'm not psycho. And people laugh, but they didn't pick me up. And my job is not to warm up the crowd on their way to work in the morning in their cars. You know, it was a comedy routine.
No.
I'm writing a hitchhiking book that never worked except for cops. That kept cops away. If I saw a cop, I'd pull that one out. And they didn't pull over much. The ones that worked best were I-70 West. It was a long distance, but it wasn't impossible. I started in Baltimore with a sign that said San Francisco, and people just laughed when they saw it. And I don't know what would have been horrible if the book of one person had picked me up out and said, I'm going to San Francisco, get in. It would have been a very dull book. I would have had to jump out. I would have had a skater ride, which could be good.
Yeah, and do the whole roll, the stunt double roll.
Yeah, the stunt double. I do that in the negative chapters when a junkie hag picks me up and throws me out.
Did you have a strategy if you didn't like the looks of someone who stopped to pick you up? Would you say thanks but no thanks? Or is that a breach of hitchhiker etiquette? Or did that never even happen to you?
Well, it never happened to me. But before you leave, you think, well, would I get in a car with, you know? And but the answer is once you're out there for 10 hours, you would get in with anybody. Freddy Krueger, that hitchhiker, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hitchhiker with a birthmark on his face. I would have gotten in his car.
Ted Bundy even wearing the sling.
Yeah, in a Volkswagen. Yeah, I'd get in anything.
Yeah. Of course, as you and I both know, you are John Waters, the titan of transgressive filmmaking, celebrated author, provocateur.
Well, thank you. My father didn't call me that.
No. Not in front of you anyway. But this begs the question. Did people recognize you?
Some did, but a lot of them drove past me and said, well, is that John Waters? Why would it be him? Why would he be standing here? And just like I had a friend that read about it on the internet when the story leaked and called my office and said, so John's had a nervous breakdown. Well, I will come and get him wherever he is in the country. Just tell me and I won't ask him any questions and I'll bring him home. Thought that I had just lost my mind, which I hadn't quite. Some people came over to give me money. A lot of people thought I was just homeless. And then some would recognize me then and start laughing and screaming and wanting to do photo shoots and everything. A lot of people didn't know who I was. And I'd try to tell them if they asked me. One farmer I knew, he didn't believe me, just took out his wallet and tried to give me $10. And I guess that was because he didn't believe me, not that he saw the grosses of my last movie and was trying to help me in my movie career.
One of the major characters in Karsak, besides yourself, of course, is the Corvette Kid. Can you tell me about him?
He was a Republican elected official. I think he's not anymore. I hope this didn't have anything to do with it. Who was in the pouring rain in Western Maryland, my third ride. He was going to the subway shop to get his lunch. And he picked me up. He didn't know who I was. I told him he had never seen any of the movies, none of her. We just kept talking, and he drove me to Ohio, which was 4 hours away, and his parents were freaking. And then he went home, and then he kept saying, I'm going to come get you again. I thought he was kidding, and I'm getting stuck in Kansas, getting stuck in Ohio, hitchhiking, and taking days. And finally, I get this ride to Kansas. He said, you're kidding. I've been driving 48 hours at 80 miles an hour, and I almost caught up to you. And I thought, is he kidding? You know, so I said, well, meet me in Denver. And I thought maybe still he was home on his computer, that the whole thing was just kind of like a hacking exercise. But he was there. We had a great adventure. We went over the Rockies. It was totally innocent, but people were incredibly perplexed by it, including his friends, who said things like, way to go. You're with a gay man in a hotel in Reno. What's going on here? And his parents were, I think, very freaked out by it, because if you're worried about your son running off with a hitchhiker and you look me up, it's not great, you know, from a parent's point of view. My career is not exactly who you want your kid to run off with. But it was totally innocent, and we just thought it was funny, kind of, that people were reacting so crazily.
John Waters is a film director and the author of Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. He spoke with Doug Gordon. Coming up, Mishi Harman, the Ira Glass of Israel, tells the story of an epic hitchhiking trip he took to win back his ex-girlfriend. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. People do all kinds of things in the wake of a breakup. Shave their heads, buy a new wardrobe, binge watch House of Cards, or, as in the story we're about to hear, hit the open road. Over the last year or so, we've been collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story, one of the most popular radio shows in Israel. It's hosted by Mishi Harman, and when he heard we were doing a show on hitchhiking, he sent us his own personal hitchhiking breakup story.
At the end of the summer of 2008, my long-term girlfriend, who I was sure I was going to marry, broke up with me. And one of the things that she said when we were breaking up was that I wasn't flexible enough. And I was just about to move to Cambridge, England to start grad school. And even though I didn't exactly know what she meant, I was completely devastated. It plain old sucked. And really the only thing that I could think about was how to get back together to Natalie. And that's actually not her name. She asked me not to use her real name on the radio, which I think you'll soon understand why. And you know how you kind of think these irrational thoughts? So I signed up to yoga studios and started going to Pilates lessons and stretching every morning. And then one rainy night, I was walking from the archaeology department to my room in Pembroke College, and I suddenly had this idea. I sort of figured it out. And if I really wanted to be flexible and I wanted to show her that I had become flexible, I needed to put myself in some situation where I had no control over what went on. So I rushed to my room and I cut out a cardboard square and scribbled anywhere in these big blue all cap letters and then just went outside ready to hitchhike to, well, anywhere. Even though this was designed as this sort of no-destination kind of trip, it's hard to shed years of inflexibility in just a second. So I harbored this secret desire that if things went really, really well, I would end up in Seville, in Spain. So Growing up, my brother always told me about his favorite paradox, which is about the barber of Seville who shaves all the men in town who don't shave themselves. And the question is, does he shave himself or not? Because if he does, then he shouldn't, and if he doesn't, then he should. And I was going through all these mind loops about Natalie, and I thought to myself that I really identified with this poor barber, and I really need to go and find this barber and get some tips about life from him. At the beginning, not many people stopped, but I was just standing on the side of these British freeways, and most of the people would slow down, take a look at my sign, kind of smile, and whiz off. My first ride was this Pakistani guy who was refilling soda vending machines, and then I got a ride with these members of a teenage punk band who stopped to rehearse in someone's basement. And then a few days later, I found myself in an all-night internet cafe in London where some gay Moroccan guy stole my Nikon D40 camera, which was highly unfortunate. But I was having a blast, because flexibility was like, I was just on a flexibility roll. And Natalie was going to be so, so surprised. I figured that I should really chronicle this journey for her. So I decided that I was going to write her postcards, one postcard every day, to tell her what I was experiencing. But very quickly, I was experiencing way too much for just one postcard. So it became two postcards a day, and three postcards, and four, and sometimes five or six or seven. And I was nuts, but I wasn't crazy. So I knew that she would be completely overwhelmed to receive all these unsolicited postcards from me all the time. So I would just put a stamp on the postcard and put it in my bag and keep it for some future day where I would give her this whole package. And there was another project going on, which was that on the flip side of the Anywhere sign, there was an equally important slogan, and it said, "I love you, Natalie." And my idea was to get people along the way to hold up this sign, and I would take a picture of them, and then I would have a world of people expressing my love. So anyway, I got onto this van of Roma people who were going to Holland, who put me onto the ferry from Dover in England to Calais in France. And on the ferry, I went to the truck driver's cafeteria to see if anyone was going to Spain. And there were plenty of people going to Spain. But no one agreed to take me, even though I cut my hair and I didn't at all look like, as my mom would say, a wilde chaya, a wild animal. And the only guy who really agreed to talk to me was this guy called Vladimir, who was this tall guy with dark hair who didn't speak a word of English. And I went to him and I said, "Vladimir, where are you going?" And he said, "Spain." So I said, "Spain, that's great. Can I come with you?" And he didn't understand what I was saying, so he said yes. And then about half an hour later, I noticed that he took this unexpected left-hand turn into Belgium. And I looked at him and I sort of pointed to the south and said sort of, you know, anxiously, "Vladimir, Spain, Spain." And he looked at me completely confused and sort of with deadpan seriousness said, "No, no Spain, Ukraine." And I thought to myself that if there was ever a moment to practice my flexibility, this was my moment. So for the next 4 days, Vladimir taught me how to drive his truck. And for the next 4 days, we went on all these sideways because Vladimir was trying to dodge the tolls and didn't talk at all. And then on the Slovenian-Ukrainian border, we were detained for a cell in a day because it turned out that Vladimir's entire truck was full of counterfeit Barbie dolls that he was trying to smuggle into the Ukraine. And then finally, once they realized that I wasn't part of the Barbie doll scheme, they let me go. And I ended up in Moscow, and I was left at the central train station, and I got onto this train, which I didn't totally realize was the Trans-Siberian Railway, which crossed all of Russia, all of frozen Siberia, the Gobi Desert, Mongolia, and ended up 9 days later in Beijing. There were almost no Westerners at all on the train. It was only Russian farmers going from one small village to another. And every night there were these crazy vodka parties in the cabin with like 30 different guys called Boris. And every few hours the train would stop at various different towns to let people on and off. And I would run out to the town with my sign and get people to hold it up with the "I love you, Natalie" sign. The pile of postcards was also growing and growing. And I was kind of thirsty for this wisdom about life. And I had met this weird Canadian hockey fan in some youth hostel in Kiev who quoted Wayne Gretzky, who said, "You miss 100% of the shots that you never take." And then a few weeks later, when the train stopped in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, finally a Westerner came aboard, this beautiful Swedish drifter called Lisa, who told me that her life motto came from John Lennon.
Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
And it just so happened that when I got to Beijing, it was the Jewish holiday of Passover. So I went to a Chabad Seder in some huge function room of a hotel. And I sat down next to this really gorgeous Israeli girl. And I was telling her all about my hitchhiking adventure. And she was clearly very, very excited. And then she said, "You know what? This is great. Why don't we continue your adventure and hitchhike together to India?" And I thought to myself, who needs a degree from Cambridge anyway? And she said, "Yeah, and we can stop in Tibet and pick up my boyfriend, Udi." And I was like, "Your boyfriend, Udi?" And even I realized that this was a sign. So I hitchhiked to the Beijing airport, and I asked the Chinese travel agent there what the cheapest flight that he had to anywhere west of there that day. So he started typing into his computer, and then he looks up to me and says that I'm in luck because there's a cheap flight that leaves in a couple of hours and still has room. And I was like, "Oh, that's great. Where is it to?" And he looked down at the computer and looked back up at me and said, "To Spain." So I did end up in Seville, and I did go to a barber. He couldn't have been farther from my fantasy. I had imagined this sort of fat, balding, sweaty Spaniard called Juan Carlo or Pedro with this huge mustache, spouting out words of wisdom about life and living within a paradox. But in reality, his name was Mustafa, and he was 20 years old, and he was a new immigrant from Algeria, and he didn't speak any language that I spoke. And the Andalusian music of my fantasy in reality was actually Celine Dion's theme song from Titanic. And he didn't give me any words of wisdom. A few months later, taking up Wayne Gretzky and, I guess, completely ignoring John Lennon, I moved back to the States to be close to Natalie to try to get back together. And on her birthday, I invited her over to my place to present her with this huge labor of love, this album of dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of pictures of people all over the world holding up the sign. A whole world of people expressing my love. And in the drawer, there was a pile of 300 plus postcards in my tiny, tiny handwriting, ready to be presented at the climactic moment of reconciliation. I began by giving Natalie the album, and she opened it up on some random page and sort of smiled and closed the book. And then, at least this is the way I remember it, she got up, put on her coat, and walked to the door. And I said, "Your album." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, was I supposed to take that?" All this happened many years ago, but this story has become, I guess, my favorite story in life. And I've told it countless times. I've told it basically on every single first date that I go on. It's like my all-star story. You know, when you tell a story so many times, you sort of kind of lose the experience of it actually happening to you. It sort of just becomes a good story. But when I really try to go back and think about what that journey meant to me, I wonder whether I actually became more flexible. I mean, I guess the truth is that I don't know, right? I mean, probably not. But, you know, I think, like, would I do something again like that? I mean, is that just something that someone in their mid-20s does because they're slightly kind of crazy? And I would like to think yeah, that is kind of the person that I am, this kind of slightly crazy romantic who, you know, hitchhikes to China to try to prove to some girl who then doesn't even take his album that they've become flexible, when, in fact, they haven't become flexible. So, that's that.
That's Mishy Harman, the host of Israel Story. We've collaborated with him on a bunch of other stories, too. You can find them on our website at ttbook.org. Israel Story will launch its second season on the Vox Tablet podcast beginning in July. That's it for our conversation about hitchhiking. But coming up, the great American poet Elizabeth Bishop was once almost forgotten. Today she's being reclaimed. Irish novelist Colm Tobin talks about her influence. And speaking of writers, we'll talk about the latest literary controversy over Charlie Hebdo and this week's Penn Award. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. With armed security standing by, the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo was presented with a Penn Freedom of Expression Award this week. Debate has been swirling around this award for weeks. Six high-profile writers boycotted the awards ceremony. Hundreds more protested, while others gave the magazine's editors a standing ovation. The director of the Penn World Voices Festival is Colm Tobin, the celebrated Irish novelist. So let's get his take on the controversy.
What was the role of Charlie Hebdo in the public life of France? And the public life of France remains deeply controversial because a great number of people feel excluded from it, including Muslim people. For example, there's no mosque in Marseille. I mean, how come? Because the people who run Marseille don't want Muslims to have a place to go to pray. Well, anyone looking at that, I think, well, that's wrong. The problem with drawing cartoons is that you can be very, very offensive in a cartoon in a way that it's quite harder to be in a novel. And some people think that if you offend a marginalized group, such as the Muslims in France, that you really are doing no one any service. Obviously, the issue arises because somebody went in and massacred these people in this magazine. And the question becomes, do you honor the magazine for its courage? Do you honor the victims for what they went through, for the appalling carnage? Since they died for drawings they made and they died for words they wrote. And Penn is an organization specifically dedicated to the defense of freedom to imagine and freedom to draw and freedom to write, then obviously Penn has to take a position about this. The question is what position to take. Penn is divided on this matter, and the division is very interesting. In Penn, there are many mansions. It isn't as though we want everyone to agree with everybody else. Writers are just not like that, and it would be awful if they were. This issue remains a burning issue. I'm going to the gala, and I'm hosting a table, and I didn't withdraw as six writers, some of whom are very good friends of mine, have withdrawn. And it's their absolute right to withdraw in that way. I have to say, I mean, I absolutely see their point that this really does have to be discussed and thrashed out. And it certainly isn't a simple matter. And I don't think it's something that will be easily resolved. With freedom of expression, you have to defend the freedom of people with whom you do not agree to do what they do. So it isn't as though you say, look, in order to honor somebody, I must agree with them. Obviously, that makes no sense, because the whole idea of freedom of expression is that it has to go against you as well as for you. The issue, it isn't merely if they're racist. It is, in a particular understanding of French society, you realize that there is a group of people, and that group is marginalized. And the cartoons certainly did not help them to feel welcome in France. That's a serious issue as to whether you want to honor people who made those cartoons, people who happened also to be massacred in broad daylight in a European city, to have people arriving in an office to actually shoot people dead for what they wrote and for what they drew, however offensive it might be. So that's the issue. I have no problem seeing both sides. I'm one of those novelists who, because I spend my life imagining other people, I'm very easy if I see a point of view thinking, well, that point of view makes sense. And then if I hear the opposite point of view, I also think that makes sense. I'm not filled with ideology. I'm sort of watching writers involved in this argument with some amazement, because I'm never able to be sure about things. I live in a vast cauldron of uncertainty.
Novelist Colm Tobin on the controversy surrounding the Pan American Center's decision to give a Freedom of Expression Award to the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Now, Colm Tobin has also just come out with a new book. It's an appreciation of the American poet Elizabeth Bishop. She's always been kind of a writer's writer, a poet whose work faded from popularity after her death, but there's been a resurgence of interest in her lately. Tobin says he has admired her for years and even feels a kind of kinship with her. Steve Paulson asked him to read a passage from the new book.
She began with the idea that little is known and that much is puzzling. The effort then to make a true statement in poetry, to claim something is something or does something, required a hushed, solitary concentration. A true statement for her carried with it, buried in its rhythm, considerable degrees of irony, because it was oddly futile. It was either too simple or too loaded to mean a great deal. It did not do anything much other than distract or briefly please the reader. Nonetheless, it was essential for Elizabeth Bishop that the words in a statement be precise and exact.
Colm, you have been reading Elizabeth Bishop's poems for years. Why does her work resonate so strongly for you?
I suppose I found when I started to read her in the 1970s, that while much was left out, in other words, there are really no confessional autobiographical poems, that within the rhythms, much is implied and left in. So there's a battle going on between, I suppose, austerity, reticence, and some way of allowing in vast amounts of ambiguous feeling, which would be contained in the poem, expressed in the poem, but not necessarily stated in the poem categorically or precisely.
So she's the opposite of those very confessional poets. I don't know, Sylvia Plath,
yeah,
someone
she,
like that.
While she tolerated to some extent Robert Lowell's confessional poems, he was a friend of hers, and she put up with that, and she praised those poems, but she really didn't like, for example, the poetry of Anne Sexton, or indeed Plath, or indeed she found, for example, the misery poems of Philip Larkin unconvincing. She was all for misery, she said, but you can't just write it down. You have to sort of win the reader by approaching it in an oblique sort of way.
Well, John Ashbery called her a writer's writer's writer, which I'm not sure.
I think that's changed.
I don't know if that's praise or not.
Well, it was a joke. I mean, James Merrill said about her that she did a lifelong imitation of an ordinary woman. I think they were all fascinated by her. But that John Ashbery statement, I think things have really changed since then. Because when he was talking about her, she was somebody that very few people had read. And they tended to be poets, and they tended to be quite rarefied poets. But now she's a very big audience. I mean, her books actually sell, and her poems are known. And her poems are canonical, so she's moved from the shadows very effectively into the center of American poetry.
Can you give me a brief outline of Elizabeth Bishop's life?
She was born in 1912. There was a great division in class between her parents. Her father was from a very rich family, and her mother was a school teacher from a small village in Nova Scotia. Her father died when she was 6 months old. At the age of five, when Bishop was five, her mother was incarcerated in a mental hospital where she lived for the rest of her life. Bishop never saw her again. Bishop was brought up by her Nova Scotia side of the family for some years until she was taken to Boston by the Boston side, and then everything emerged, the, you know, eczema, the asthma, the deep unhappiness. And, I mean, she was lesbian. She generally had a partner, but the big love affair really happened when she went to Brazil in the early 1950s, and she fell in love with a very rich Brazilian woman and a very glorious sort of woman who was in the higher echelons of Brazilian society, a woman called Lota de Macedo Soares. And they were together for about 15 years. They had a whale of a time in Brazil. Then eventually things fell apart and Lota committed suicide in New York. And I think she left Bishop really forlorn. Bishop went back eventually to New England and she taught at Harvard and then ended up living in Boston where she died in 1979.
Hmm. Now, clearly, you see some similarities between her life and your own life, and this is something you write about quite a bit in your book, starting with where each of you grew up. What are some of the parallels?
I grew up in County Wexford, which has sea on two sides. It's rural Ireland, and people have very good manners. They are very careful what they say. They're very watchful. I found a lot of that in Nova Scotia, and indeed in Bishop's poems about Nova Scotia. People talk in hushed voices. People hint at things rather than declare them.
So this is a language of restraint. I mean, you don't sort of...
Yes,
everything
yes,
is understated.
Yes. That's correct. And I lost my father. My father got sick when I was 8 and died when I was 12. Plus, I'm gay, which Bishop was. So, I mean, I have all of that. But also, I suppose in the prose I write, I tend to write pretty, pared back sentences. I don't write big, long, sort of Moby Dick sentences. And, I might have got that from Bishop in some way, but also I recognize something in Bishop that was in myself.
Well, we should quote something from Bishop's own poetry, and maybe you could read something from what is probably her most famous poem, One Art.
Yeah, her most famous poem is called One Art. It's villanelle, meaning that it uses systems of repetition. The first line is, "The art of losing isn't hard to master." And then she finds rhyme words for that, like disaster. And she takes you through all the things she lost, which begins with keys and small things. And these are the last two stanzas of the poem. And, of course, she's been describing small things she lost, and now she's moving into the big things. "I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vast are some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. The art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster." And when people saw that poem, they thought that finally she had said what the problems were about losing. But actually, she doesn't mention her father or her mother. She doesn't mention, this is written after Lota's suicide, she doesn't mention that either. So it's a sort of almost a whimsical poem where she's trying to write about something serious while actually holding back and leaving out quite a lot.
Now, one of the great pleasures of your book is how you weave your own personal history into your writing about Elizabeth Bishop. And you say, for instance, that you also have a close relationship with silence, with things withheld, with things known and not said. Can you tell me more about that, about how that figures into your own sensibility?
You often wonder if people could feel things more deeply or indeed express them more deeply by being very careful with them and reticent and withholding, where there are things you simply don't want to write about. You feel that they come to you so ambiguously, that they come like waves because they go out again. So I think something like grief is something that people will recognize as being, it's often there in the morning, say. By the afternoon, it seems to have gone. You know it's coming back, but you don't know when. I think that's an interesting thing to write about, rather than writing about grief as though it's one single set of feelings. So, I mean, for me, sometimes not writing about things that really matter to me, and certainly not talking about them. I mean, I know that we live in an age where you're meant to, even with the most casual acquaintance, sit down and tell them all about how you feel this week. Well, I don't tend to do that.
So do you think talking about these things kind of takes away from the real experience?
I think if certain things happen to you and you feel them very deeply, you can become very uneasy about having them soiled by speech, that somehow or other speech is just not accurate enough, that language is simply not clear enough.
Now, you've mentioned her friendship with an even more famous poet, Robert Lowell, and they knew each other for a long time, communicated mostly by letters. Clearly, there was a great deal of mutual affection, of admiration, and also, it would seem, some competitiveness. How would you describe their relationship?
Well, she admired his work enormously, and he admired her work, and they're always writing to each other to say how much they admired one another's work. But the last big argument between them was really a very serious one. When Lowell's marriage broke up and he was living in London, and his wife, Elizabeth Hardwick, is the wife he'd broken up from, she wrote him these heartbroken letters. And Lowell decided to make the letters into sonnets and publish them without a permission. And Bishop wrote him a very stern letter. And what she said, I think, is an interesting moment in the history of freedom of expression and censorship. She said to him, look, don't let anyone tell you these are not art. Whatever you've managed to do to these letters, you've made art. This is art. But what you have to remember is it isn't worth it. And, you know, we always are made feel, oh, no matter what it is, if it's art, it's worth, you know, you can do anything for the sake of art. She said, not this time, that, you know, she said what you've done is infinite mischief by taking these private letters and making them into public sonnets.
Hmm. Now, you also draw some parallels between Bishop and your fellow Irishman, James Joyce, two writers who, of course, chose self-imposed exile. And you have a lovely passage where you describe some of those connections. And could you read it?
Yeah, right. Okay. In Joyce's Irish Catholic world and in the beliefs of Bishop's Baptist upbringing, the relationship to God is stark, almost simple. When faith disappears, as it did with these two writers, then the language of transcendence can have a special power because it invokes something that was once familiar, once possible, and is now lost. Faith goes, language remains. Slowly the new faithless language takes on a power much greater than it ever had when it was there merely to express faith. Language is all there is now. And in the ambiguous space created by a precise and exact evocation of the past, a single concluding image, the image of the snow in Joyce and the quasi-religious images of water in Bishop, is allowed to soar above the ordinary universe like a hymn or an aria, something filled with rising cadence. A sort of homecoming is enacted by allowing the image to transform itself, free itself from the shackles of the concrete, the positive, the world of things, and move like a boat sent to rescue someone into an uneasy, shimmering, almost philosophical, almost religious space, using words with both freedom and restraint, suggesting something that has not been formulated or imagined by anyone before.
That's the Irish novelist Colm Tobin talking with Steve Paulson about his new book on Elizabeth Bishop. And that's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. If you haven't already, we'd love it if you'd subscribe. That way you'll never miss another hour, and you'll help us grow our podcast audience. Just search for To the Best of Our Knowledge on your favorite podcast app, like iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling generous, leave a comment. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Special thanks to engineer Joe Hartke for his help this week. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.